welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, August 16, 2021. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Real Vision's Jack Farley and our guest, Jared Dillian from the Daily Dirt Nap. Let's take a look at what's happening right now. S&P 500 takes out another 52-week high after overcoming a pretty sloppy open on the day. Looks like closing out the day at 4,479, up only 0.75% on the day. Dow also fractionally higher, NASDAQ fractionally lower, closing at 14,793. And the VIX looks like it tops 16, up looks like 0.61%. Jack, what are you looking at right now?
Growth in the New York State stalled for the month of July. That's according to the Empire State Manufacturing Survey. New orders and shipments grew modestly, and input prices continued to rise sharply. But the story, Ash, is a familiar one, the same one we've seen over the past few months, an expanding economy whose expansion is itself slowing down. Ash?
Yeah. You know, Jack, talking about pressure on global growth, looking at numbers coming out of China, more pressure. Industrial output and retail sales continued a very steep decline. July data, 6.4 and 8.4 for industrial output and retail sales. These are massive declines from peak, as you can see by looking at the chart next to me right now. Interesting note, a Bloomberg study over the weekend used a two-year average to strip out base effects from the pandemic. The result, a notable slowdown in retail sales in China. This is after removing pandemic base effects. Jack, I understand you're looking at another story on the Fed.
Yeah, well, Ash, that really is why the bond market has been rallying. It's been all too willing to forgive frothy inflation prints that we've seen over the past 3 months, namely because it is worried about a slowdown in growth. Of course, what it really hinges on is the Federal Reserve. When will the Fed start to taper their asset purchases? Several Fed chairs have recently indicated that conditions for tapering could be much sooner than people think, as early as of October as this year. I know Jared Dillian, our guest, has a really interesting take on this.
Well, that's a perfect way to cue it up. Jared, welcome back to Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hey. So, you know, the Fed basically gets like free tightening without any tightening. Like, you know, they can talk about tapering. They're very hawkish in their speeches. You know, I saw some stuff today. The Fed is getting more hawkish. And they can sort of, you know, talk down bond yields through this talk about tapering. But, you know, really, ultimately, I don't think they're going to taper with unemployment at 5.4%. I don't think they're going to do it. So really what they're doing, I mean, it's actually some kind of sophisticated game theory by the Fed. You know, they get to taper in this free way without actually having to tighten monetary policy. And I think that when we get to October, I think, you know, there's a million reasons not to tighten, and, you know, they'll have some excuse and we'll get pushed to December and we'll be into next year. And, you know, they can't do this indefinitely, but they can do it for a while.
Jared, that's a great point about the sort of moral suasion, the jawboning effect relative to what's actually happening. Jack, I want to jump in and ask Jared a few questions on that. What are your thoughts?
Well, Jared, it seems to me that if what you're saying is correct, that the Federal Reserve is bringing people into the bond market because of they keep on talking about tapering, what they really want to forestall is a rout in the bond market, the type that we saw in February and March. It seems to me, though, that this strategy is a smart one, but it's one that has a shelf life. You can't do this forever. Eventually people, particularly bond investors, are going to catch on to the game. What happens then?
Well, what happens then is we'll get this big inflationary impulse in the stock market. The back end yields will go up. We'll get this big curve steepening. Gold will go up. And that's kind of when the inflation trade happens again. See, right now, you know, the market goes through phases of either believing or not believing the Fed. The Fed can have credibility or not have credibility. For some reason, right now, the Fed has lots of credibility. The market, when the Fed says they're going to taper in October, like the market takes them at their word. But that isn't always the case. And when belief turns into disbelief and the market loses confidence in the Fed's proclamations, that's when you get that curve steepening and that inflationary impulse.
Yeah. All right, guys, let me throw this one out. We talk about tightening. We talk about hawkishness coming out of the Fed. For folks who don't follow the bond market as closely as you do, Jared, and you do, Jack, I would add this. It's not really tightening. It's just less loosening, right? It's not really hawkishness. It's just marginally less dovishness. We're talking about tapering back the rate at which the Fed is purchasing bonds, certainly not unwinding the portfolio. I think it's important for people to keep that in mind when we talk about it. Give us a little bit of a context, Jared, about what you think about the overall big picture about where we are in this extraordinary cycle of loosening.
Well, I mean, our definition of hawkish has certainly changed over time. Like they talk about the Overton window, like we've definitely yeah. moved the Overton window, like cutting QE from 120 billion a month to 90 billion a month is hawkish now. But having said that, you know, the last time the Fed tapered, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, that actually did have a material impact on the markets. The stock market, the rate of change of the stock market went down, and there actually was a pretty big effect. So, you know, I think if the Fed did still, let's just say hypothetically, they started to taper in October and it extended into next year, by the time they got around to talking about a rate hike, like the markets would be pretty choppy by then. Like it would actually, it does have an effect.
Yeah, very well said. By the way, the Overton window, for those who don't follow political science, is the window of acceptable opinion. And that has shrunk basically around the degree of loose monetary policy that we have right now. Jack, jump in.
I want to know what happens, what assets will react once the Fed starts tapering. I know I've done a little bit of work on what happened when the Federal Reserve raised rates in 2018. And the stocks that were most affected tended to be actually long duration technology stocks, not your cyclical stocks. However, it seems now that the market thinks that the ones that will be most affected by a tapering are the extremely cyclical ones, particularly the energy sector. Jared, you have been an investor in the energy sector this year as part of your inflationary thesis. Do you agree with the market that these cyclical names, energy stocks, reflation names, oil, whatever you want to call it, are the ones that will take the most damage if the Fed starts to taper, to actually taper, rather than jawbone, as you said?
It's hard to say. We don't really know. It could, by the time the Fed actually tapers, it could be a sell the news event. And the market frequently behaves in ways that are, you know, completely contrary to what we think is going to happen. You know, if we look at this in a very linear way and say the Fed tapers, cyclical stocks are going down, right? That looking at things in a linear way almost never works, right? The market does the opposite of what we think it's going to do. So I think it's entirely possible we get to October or whenever they taper next year or whatever, and they actually start and, you know, something different happens.
And it's probably a good thing, too. If markets were rational and linear, we probably wouldn't have a job. So it's a good thing that we have this complexity to sort through. Let me just ask you this, something that may seem like I'm throwing out a bit of a wild card here, but let me try and walk it back to where we are right now. One of the biggest news stories of the last, 20 years, the Taliban seizing control in Afghanistan over the weekend, a massive news story. It's very much reminiscent of a story going back to 1975, April 30th, 1975, when the embassy at Saigon fell. The images are very similar. The emotional resonance of it is very similar. Here we are about 10 minutes into the daily briefing. We haven't even mentioned this yet. The question is this: has Fed policy, has the constant level of liquidity being pumped into the system changed our perspective on how events influence markets? In other words, you have this seismic event involving a 20-year commitment of troops from the United States in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and it doesn't seem to be rattling markets one way or the other. What we're talking about here is what we always talk about, which is what the Fed is doing. Is that itself an index of how markets are being impacted by monetary policy? Jared?
No, actually, I don't think it's an indication of that at all. You know, first of all, Afghanistan doesn't have any financial significance at all. I mean, it has huge geopolitical significance, but it doesn't really have any financial significance. It has sentiment significance. Okay. So when we walked into the market this morning and stocks were down, futures were down overnight. I forget how much they were down this morning, yeah. 70 basis points or something like that. I mean, that was a product of the negative sentiment of what was going on in Afghanistan. what today is, it reminds me of the London bombings of 2007. Okay, the price action today is a direct parallel. We opened down, traded lower, and then rallied furiously into the end of the day, right? So basically, we walked in with that negative sentiment, and the market sort of digested it and looked past it and said, okay, this doesn't have any long-term impact, and we rallied. So now, having said that, what's going on in Afghanistan, I think makes me a little less bullish longer term, because what we've done is we've opened this geopolitical Pandora's box, okay? And I'm far from an expert on geopolitical stuff, so just maybe you should discount whatever I say. But I look at this, you know, as an outside observer, and I say we are perceived to be being weak or ineffectual on Afghanistan, which opens the door to Russia and China acting more aggressively. And those events, whether it's Russia and Ukraine or China and Taiwan, those are the types of events that are really black swan events that could happen at some point in the future. So the probability of something like that happening has gone up just a tiny amount. So it makes me slightly less bullish.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
By the way, we should probably add President Biden speaking right now at this hour, around 4:15 Eastern time, about Afghanistan. Jack, jump in. What are your thoughts?
Yeah.
Jared's got an interesting point on the sentiment indicator. Basically shrugged it off in 8 hours. What are you thinking?
I think that it does make some sense that if, you know, you're Coca-Cola and 19% of your revenues come from Mexico and next is from the U.S. and, you know, not a lot comes from Afghanistan, it's not really going to impact the business there. So I don't see a reason why it would, you know, roil the equity market. You did see some sell-offs in sovereign bonds, like Pakistani bonds, yeah. And the like. I saw an article in the FT about that. I want to... move topics, just get Jared's sense of last week's CPI print. And Jared, on Friday, you had a daily dirt nap where the title was "The Numbers Are Bad." And that was a reference to a scene in the show Lost. Of course, the numbers being 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42. I want to ask you, are the numbers are bad? Are you referring to 5.0, 5.4, 5.4? That is the last CPI prints that we've had over the last month? Because Jared, it seems to me like if you or Peter Buchvar or a lot of, you know, inflationary people with inflationary views had wrote down on, let's say, January of this year, your predictions for inflation, and then the deflationary people wrote down their predictions, it seems like you and Peter would definitely have been in the right. It's just that the asset markets haven't reacted accordingly. Bonds have rallied over the past 2 months. Cyclical stocks have gone down, not up. What's going on here?
I don't know. I mean, it gets back to what I was talking about before. You know, I mean, the stock market, the financial markets frequently do the opposite of what we think is going to happen. So if I were able to predict like 8 months ago that we'd have, you know, inflation close to 6% and, you know, energy and cyclicals and all this stuff would be in like a 6 month bear market. Like, you would have to be insane to come up with that prediction. Like, that would take an insane person. So I don't know what's going on. You know, a lot of it does have to do with positioning, you know, because, those trades, if you go back to February, March, Got pretty overextended. There were a lot of late longs. There was a lot of victory laps. I probably took some myself. And you have to flush out the late longs. A lot of it's just positioning. Okay. Yep. So I really think it's a consolidation that's going to resolve higher at some point.
Yeah, if it doesn't make sense, it's often positioning. By the way, one of the best belly laughs we've had on the show in some time, right there, Jerry. By the way, talking, I should say, about inflation, deflation. Jack, you did an expert view with Dan Rasmussen out today. Let's set up the clip for that. Jump in, Jack.
Yeah, so Dan talked a lot about crisis investing, but we did ask him his view on inflation and what sort of assets perform well during inflation. Let's take a look.
You got to be thinking about commodities if you're worried about inflation. I think people should be worried about inflation right now. It's a risk. Now, risk doesn't mean there's 100% chance it's going to happen, but there's a decent probability it will. And so you want to be prepared and thoughtful about what you're doing to protect your portfolio in the event of inflation. Now, let's take the probably three biggest commodities in terms of their trading volume, which are energy commodities, specifically oil, copper, and then gold. And I know that people are going to say gold's a currency, and I get that argument. I agree with it, but let's consider it as part of commodities for now. Oil and copper are growth-linked commodities. So they do well when growth and inflation are rising. If inflation is rising and growth is falling, right, that's putting pressure on demand. So it can cause a falling price environment, even if there's inflation. Or you can have inflation that's, you know, caused, say, by oil. So depending on the cause of inflation, growth in copper might or might not work. But really think about them very robustly working in sort of the reflationary environment that we've been in since spreads started to tighten and things really got going again, right? That was a reflationary environment. It's a classic environment, which in oil and copper really dramatically outperform. But then as you enter the late cycles, growth starts falling and those demand pressures get put on the buyers of oil and copper. Their reliability work is a lot lower. So what you want to be thinking about is gold.
Jack, back to you. Contextualize what we just saw.
So Dan is saying that when growth and inflation are running hot, you want to have oil and copper. That's when they do well. However, if inflation is hot, but growth not so much and it's slowing down, that's when you want to shift your exposure more to gold. So my question for you, Jared, is number one, do you agree that during stagflationary times, gold is king, essentially? And number two, to what sense do you see slowing growth in the economy right now? You know, Ash mentions there's slowing growth in China based on retail sales. The Empire State Manufacturing Index is seeing a bit of a grind down in growth as well. And if inflation continues to run as hot as you think it will, but growth is sort of on the back foot, do you think that gold will be the best way to play that?
So I agree with pretty much everything you said. I don't like this slowing growth narrative that is developing. Okay, I don't think this is, I've said this on the show before, like the inflation that we're experiencing right now is not analogous to the inflation that we experienced in the 1970s. It's very different. And even though the rate of change of some of these numbers is kind of dropping, I think a lot of people are looking at this slowing growth and they're saying, oh my God, this is recessionary. And this justifies what's going in the bond market. And there's this whole narrative about it. Growth is coming off a very high level to a slightly less high level. Okay. So I think that all these cyclical inflation hedges like energy, I think they do continue to work. You know, I think gold should work too. But, you know, like I said, I mostly agree with the statement.
Yeah. Reminds me a little of the framework that Dan set up of what we've seen Darius Dale talk about in the grid view of the economy, trying to analyze the relationship between growth and inflation. Guys, let's jump in. We have some great questions here from the audience. Here's one that comes to us from Christopher Moore from The Exchange, and this one's to Jared. It's a great question. What is your take on, quote, markets don't fall when everyone is ready for it, close quote? Surely this is one of the most hated rallies. Volume has been declining since July.
Well, I think sentiment is actually pretty neutral right now. I would not say that it's overly bullish. I would not say that it's overly bearish. I mean, for sure, you have, you know, people who are perma bears that, you know, think the market is going to collapse in any time. But I think sentiment is pretty neutral, which I think is constructive for the rally to continue, which is what happened today. By the way, this is the Chumbawamba market. Right,
What's happening?
It gets knocked. it gets knocked down and it gets up again. You know, so, I mean,
this is before Jack's time, Jared. We got to fill it in.
1996. So actually, that's when you were born, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
sorry. Anyway, so really, like, the price action today is pretty emblematic of like what's going on with the stock market. Like it just it doesn't die. It continues to suck people in. So yeah, I'm supposed to be the expert on sentiment. I think it's pretty neutral, and I think it's pretty constructive.
Over to you in a second, Jack. But Jared, set up a little bit how you look at sentiment, what your gauges are, and how you make that determination.
Well, you know, people ask me this all the time. Like, how do you analyze sentiment?
I've asked you this before.
Yeah, it's great question. And I think what I told you is that it's voodoo. Like it's. There's nothing quantitative. I mean, look, there's sentiment surveys. There's like AII, and there's all kinds of technical indicators and put call ratios and skew and stuff like that. And you can look at that stuff. But really, generally, it's me spending too much time on Twitter and just listening to what people are saying. You know, actually, I don't know if you follow me on Twitter, but I don't tweet a lot. You know, I tweet like 5 or 6 times a day, but I spend most of my time really paying attention to what other people are saying. And I use that as inputs for my own analysis.
Yeah. If you don't follow Jared Dillian on Twitter, you should @DailyDirtNap.
Yeah. Jared, I want to lean into the voodoo a little bit. And I know that sometimes what a strong signal to you is when there's a headline on a major magazine for a particular story that has been going up and up. So for example, I think when Bitcoin was on the cover of Barron's, that signaled to you a top, and I think the timing was relatively right based on the price action from then till now. Do you think that the deflation narrative, the recession narrative, the growth is slowing narrative, are you seeing any signs of that where, you know, smack, the Wall Street Journal goes down on your table and you see the story and you say, this is fully priced in?
No, it's not priced in. I think it's in the early stages of being priced in. And I think if the data deteriorates some more, you'll start to see some articles on it. I mean, the thing you have to remember about the profession of journalism, and I'm not like crapping on journalism because we're all sort of journalists here, right? But what journalists do is they don't predict the future. They write about what's hot, what's new, what's in the news right now, what's getting the most clicks. And that generally marks short-term tops and bottoms in sentiment. So I haven't really seen any articles about this slowing growth narrative, but I'm sure we'll see some in the next couple of weeks.
Boy, that's exactly right, Jared. I want to change my my Twitter bio to sort of journalist. But you know, kidding aside, that's what we do here, and that's one of the reasons why we're always so happy when you can join us here on Real Vision Daily Briefing and then some of the other content that we do here, because we try and look beyond the headlines. We try and look beyond what the sentiment indicators are in terms of the popular culture and actually look into the story. And why it's so important to have conversations like these. Jack, I'm sorry, you were going to say.
Yeah, I think that so often there are headlines in the news where it's stock market crashes or something, and it's down 70 basis points from its all-time highs. It didn't crash, and it's stock crashes on inflation fears. And why inflation fears? Because we saw some index, but actually, if you look at the inflation break-even rate, which is what the market is pricing forward inflation derived from the Treasury inflation protected security yield, the TIPS yield, actually inflation break-evens went down. So it's I agree with what Jared said, and it's not the journalist's fault. It's just that they have a obligation to put out content like 5 times a day, and that's sort of what the result is. But you know, we here at Real Vision, we like to go a little bit deeper. And Ash, that's why I'm really glad that you mentioned in the beginning the 2-year rate of change data. And this is something that, you know, macro investor Teddy Valley has shared with me, that essentially these yearly comps are nonsense because you're comparing now to last year, and everything was messed up by the pandemic and then the according enormous amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus. So of course, growth is going to look red hot in March and April and May, and it's going to cool down from there. So a lot of people are using that 2-year rate of change, which I think makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, it's a good way to normalize, to get out some of the pandemic bounce back, to understand where you are relative to effectively what was trend pre-pandemic. By the way, talking about journalists and headlines, I have to say, just crossing right now, this is a CNBC headline from the Biden speech, quote, Biden says Afghanistan war was a lost cause, vows to continue aid and diplomacy. That just crossing the wire right now from CNBC, obviously a sobering headline. Talking of sobering, Jared, here's a question that comes to us from Eric Frith. The question is, what's the best way to prep a portfolio for stagflation?
Gold for sure. Actually, stagflation is tough because everything loses. You know, stocks lose, bonds lose, commodities are generally okay. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, like, that was a great time for commodities. And if you know anything about the turtle traders, like, that's how those, all the trend followers, like, that's how they got their start, was trend following all these commodities in the 70s and the 80s, you know? So there's, I mean, there is this saying that there's always a bull market somewhere. That's, you know, it's totally true.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, Jared, I think that is a tagline for Jim Cramer's show. There's always a bull market somewhere. Jared, so it sounds like you are obviously enormously, you remain bullish on the energy trade, but that's a long-term view. Are there any bull markets now that you're excited about now where you wouldn't hedge it by said, yeah, the next 3 months are probably going to be rough, but it's a long-term story?
You really want to know?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm really paying attention to NFTs right now. I'm super interested in NFTs, and actually, for my MFA, I'm taking an art history class, and I'm doing a paper on NFTs, which is kind of cheating because it's really a finance paper for an art class. So this is kind of the second wave of the NFT bull market. The first wave was back in March. Which peaked when Beeple sold every days for $69 million, right? And then kind of the air came out of it, and now people are trading NFT penguins for $500,000 and stuff like that. You know, the interesting thing is, and I wrote about this for my daily Dirt Nap tomorrow, you know, I'm building a house, and I'm thinking ahead about what kind of art I want to put in the house, and there's a lot of digital artists that I like. So I went online, and I'm looking at some of their stuff that you can get in NFT form. And it's actually pretty reasonable. It's like $500-$600. You know, so you get this JPEG and you take it to a printer and you blow it up and you make a print and you stick it on your wall. I think over time, this NFT market will sort of converge where all the crap that people are buying right now, which are really, you know, just like Beanie Baby collectibles, I think that stuff will decline in value. But actual good digital intellectual property will probably increase in value over time.
Yeah, that's such a great point. You know, I have to tell you, over the weekend, a friend asked me to send him a couple of articles about NFTs, and obviously Bored Ape Yacht Club, Pudgy Penguins, these are things that are very much on the radar of people who follow NFTs. So I sent this guy two articles that were especially interesting to me, and I realized after I clicked the send button that they were from The New Yorker and The New York Times, not our friends at CoinDesk, not our friends at Decrypt, but The New Yorker and The New York Times. It's interesting to me that NFTs with digital art, with the appeal that these sort of artistic renderings have, breaking through into public consciousness in a way that you don't see. For example, The New Yorker is not writing about liquidity pools.
Yeah, The New Yorker has actually, I've read their NFT stuff, and it's actually really, really good. It's very good. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting to me as just an indicator of that almost crossing the threshold of consciousness.
Well, you know, Ash, you really led the Real Vision crypto community during the first NFT bull run. By you had your NFT. It was was it called irresponsibly or aggressively neutral? I don't know if it was exactly that, but it was you and the red microphone, which you no longer have. Now you have a black and gray microphone.
Does that make it more valuable, Jack? The fact
I think it does. We need like a skin. I was actually planning on doing some work, but then the bull market sort of turned over. So now I'm going to have to revisit that possibility. But I want to say that with NFTs, and Jaron, you said all the crap you said will be flushed out. It really is, dependent on the product that you buy. If you buy a piece of art for $1,000, you know, it may be worthless in 5 years at the same time that Ethereum is $20,000 per unit. So it really is very, very dependent. Jaron, what drew your interest into NFTs? I don't think I've quite caught the bug yet, but I'm looking to be, you know, swept away.
Well, you know, because I'm a music guy, right? So, you know, the internet killed the music industry, you know, Napster. I mean, if you go back to 1999, 2000, the ability to share, you know, for somebody to burn a CD into MP3s and share them on the internet, I mean, destroyed the music industry. And, you know, the music industry is doing fine, but it's changed over time and it's turned into this winner take all business model as a result of that. But I've always been interested, you know, I've been saying this for a year, if there was a way to protect digital intellectual property, to preserve property rights with digital IP, that would be one of the greatest innovations of all time. And NFTs aren't perfect. They consume a huge amount of energy. There's a lot of fees. They're not easy to use. But I think that'll get better over time.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, Ethereum switching to proof of stake, many of these NFTs, in fact, the majority of them are based in Ethereum, has the potential to do that. It's also interesting. There's an argument that goes, Jared, as you probably well know, that the music industry killed itself by suing its own customers and not figuring out a way to give people an opportunity. I think there were a lot of people who were using Napster that would have been thrilled to pay 99 cents per song, but there wasn't a legal opportunity for them to do it. And as a consequence, you know, the industry happened. Well, what happened to the industry? And it was a brutal one. So I'm curious to see if you're optimistic about some of these new technologies to really empower artists on the music side, on the graphic and visual side. Are you optimistic about what you see coming down the pike, or are you still saying it's too early to say?
No, I'm very optimistic, and I think, you know, it's the like the top of the first inning. There's a lot of work to do, but there's a DJ that I follow. His name is Davi. He's like a deep house DJ, kind of a quiet guy, kind of an introvert. And he actually did a long post on Facebook about 6 months ago about how screwed, you know, because basically he's producing these tracks and he's selling them on Beatport and he's getting like 90 cents. He's like, this doesn't make any sense. So then he goes to Brian Armstrong, CEO of Coinbase, and they sit down and produce a track together. And of course, Brian Armstrong doesn't know what the hell he's doing. Like he's basically, you know, he's just kind of along for the ride. But they produce this track and they sell it as an NFT for $27,000.
Pretty cool story. Jack, any final thoughts on Deep House?
I just want to listen to Jared's next release. That's what I'd buy a Jerry Dillon NFT.
I thought about doing an NFT of the very first issue of the Daily Dirt Nap.
Ooh. Oh, cool.
That would be a good one.
I'm also long on Jared Dillon from the music side.
Yeah. My NFT is me reading a book that is out of copyrights. So something like, you know, Where Are All the Customers' Yachts or some sort of classic book like that.
You can do like an Andy Kaufman reading of The Great Gatsby.
I am. Jared, because now that we're deep in the world of crypto, how are you viewing Bitcoin and Bitcoin's rise over the past month and a half? You're really on the inflation trade. I know you've written, what if my thesis was right about inflation, but I'm just not owning the right assets?
Mm. Yeah, so I did a piece in the Daily Dirt Nap. I think it was today's issue, maybe. And I said, okay, we have the inflation thesis and we have conviction that thesis is correct. Do we have the right portfolio? And I looked at the portfolio that I have and I said, you know what? Like, this isn't really like a 10x portfolio. Like this is a generational thesis. Like, this is like a once in 30 year opportunity. And if you get it right, you don't want to make 2x, you want to make 10x. And I'm looking at my portfolio. I'm like, this is kind of a 2x portfolio. So I actually posed the question to my readers. I said, what is the 10x asset that benefits from inflation? And it was literally like head slap. It's Bitcoin. Like, that's what it is. And it's the one thing that I don't own, because I basically traded it and I sold out of it back in the beginning of this year, and I never bought back in. And I don't have the right inflation play. That is what seems to be working right now.
It is so interesting to look at the correlation between Bitcoin and inflation and how it's varied over the years.
Yes, but Ash, that is a great question, and there's so much you can get into. But one would argue that a true inflation hedge would increase or decrease alongside the CPI. So the fact that gold has performed meagerly over the past decade, that actually indicates to me that it's been a pretty good inflation hedge, because inflation has been muted. Something that increases 1,000 times while inflation, you know, continues to pace at 2% per year, that seems that there's a lot more going on there. And I specifically, the folks at Quant Insight have done a lot of work on this. And at least as of a few months ago, I think the biggest drivers, macro drivers of Bitcoin were the five-year Chinese credit default swap, sovereign that, because it's a lot of action in China, that may be over, as well as some curve steepeners and central bank balance sheet expansion expectations as measured by swaption volatility. So yeah, the whole,
swaption. Listen, Jack, this starts to remind me of the stories that were written about how news stories with Anne Hathaway, the actress from The Princess Bride, correlated with rising Berkshire Hathaway stock prices. This idea that Hathaway, you can find these weird spurious correlations if you crawl a deep enough data set. But it almost seems, to your point, is that all the old correlations, the traditional chestnuts you mentioned, what happens with the bond market when you get piping hot CPI prints, it seems like a lot of this is breaking down.
Oh, yeah. And I'd say that what the goal of principal component analysis is to avoid exactly those spurious correlations. Jared, from I hope you remember this, from a few months back in one of your daily dirt dumps, you had something where it's like the Fed prints money, brr. And that's sort of the like IQ quotient, I guess. And then you had someone say this really complex thing in the middle, blah, blah, blah. But then really smart people actually understand it. So maybe I'm in the middle where I'm saying this extremely complicated thing, but maybe you are right that Bitcoin, Bitcoin's denominated in dollars, and the more dollars there are, the more.
Yeah, that's called the tyranny of the mid curve.
Yeah.
People in the middle make things way more complicated than it needs to be. The Fed's printing money, it's going on.
Yep. Yeah, I'm doomed to be in the middle.
You know, gentlemen, this is one of those shows that I wish could never end, but we're coming to the conclusion here. We've run about a few minutes over. Jack, final thoughts?
I think everything will hinge on the Federal Reserve's tapering and the market's expectations of them. Growth is slowing.
We can record that, Jack, and use it as your final thoughts for like the next 6 months. That's like perfect.
No, well, I got to say it in a different way so people feel like it's fresh, even though I'm saying it again. No.
Just change your shirt.
I think that, I mean, things are getting a little steep. Things are fresh. I feel like, I don't know, there are more reasons to be bearish now than a few months ago because everything is peaked. Like, yes, growth is still positive, but growth itself is decelerating. Liquidity is decelerating. I don't know. Sorry, I don't mean to be a Cassandra right as we end the show over time. But I want to hear what Jared's final thoughts are.
Yeah, I was going to say, final thoughts to you, Jared.
I think we got to get through to Labor Day. You know, I got probably the most out of office replies today than I have ever. People are taking the last 2 weeks of the summer off. This is just trader talk, but when we get back after Labor Day, things are going to be rocking, and people are going to have risk to transfer. So it's going to be exciting.
It's going to be a fun time. Jared, hey, as always, really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching, everybody.